From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in three places. In the classroom, in the boardroom, and in the doctor's office. We continue our preview of the Upstate Latino Summit, which happens this coming Wednesday in Rochester at the Rochester Riverside Convention Center. Last hour, we had a conversation about political engagement, immigration, sometimes how those two things tie together, and how to get more of our Latino community out to vote. Well, this hour, we're looking at things like healthcare, education, and we'll start with a conversation about business with a few people who have had plenty of success based on their own experience in business. We've asked them to come in and share their experience with us. So first, let me welcome back Michelle Faust, my colleague. How are you?
Hi.
That was an hour that could have been three.
Always.
That really was, yeah. And we thank our audience for their engagement as well. And let me welcome our guests for this segment. We have Andrea Holland here. Andrea, it's funny. I actually didn't ask you how you wanted to be introduced. You have so many different titles. What is
that? That happens when you're entrepreneurial in spirit.
I know. And you've done so many things. So let's pretend we're not on the air. Andrea, how would you like to be introduced?
For the sake of this interview, yeah. I'll say you can call me a communications coach and consultant.
Okay. There's that. And there's a lot more behind Andrea Holland. We'll talk to her in a moment about that. And Julio Sainz as well. He is the owner of Digital Diversity. It's a marketing business focused on multicultural marketing. But Julio, let's be honest, I could have called you a bunch of different things too.
Yeah, that's depending on the day and the situation. But you know, once again, I think that's entrepreneurial spirit as you described.
Now, before the hour began, Andrea Holland gave us a bit of a warning. And she said, you know, whatever, if there's any sort of a typical a conversation about Latinos in business, we might not get it from her.
No.
And I said, no, that's good. This is very good because you are somebody who's had a lot of success in a lot of different places. Mm-hmm. And I think partially at least due to your mentality, which is what, Andrea?
As you said it after we were talking about it, I have sort of a no excuses mentality. I've had a portfolio career, I guess you could say, where most people stay in jobs for, you know, 20 years and so on and so forth. Me, I'm like 4 years. Well, I've learned all I can learn. And it's time to boogie. And I leap, and I always leap before there is a net, and I just sort of figure it out as I go. But I think part of my success in doing that has been the no excuses mentality, that I don't view any sort of my gender, my ethnicity, my background, my education, anything as something that could hold me back. I've never felt disadvantaged in any way. And I'm not saying that there haven't been moments where I've walked into a room and people thought, here comes the Rican. You know, I'm just being honest and thought, I don't know if she's the right fit for the job. And I've had people tell me that, but I don't count those as part of, against my success. I thrive in spite of it.
Yeah, I hear what Andrea is saying, and I don't think what I'm hearing is there's no such thing as minority disadvantage.
It's there. It's very much there.
You just have a determination to cut through it and to sort of just
Our background, my family's background, and my mother one day, I was laid off from a job, and my mother came up to me. I was so sad. I was standing in my living room, and she came up to me with a lot of paper towels, rolls of paper towels, because that's what you need when you lose your job, apparently.
Paper towels.
And she just hugged me, and she goes, "It's okay, Mama. We are survivals." I said, "I'm sorry, what did you say? No, did you mean survivors?" "Boy, yes, survivals. We're going to be just fine." And that has been my upbringing. It doesn't matter if you have, you know, a million or one. You're going to be just fine. You're going to be okay. You have the desire, the drive, the know-how, the skill. And if you don't have it, you'll get it one way or the other because we're survivors.
Now,
it's our culture, mm-hmm. I feel.
I think you could get in front of a room of people in business, women in business, Latinos in business, and instill that kind of confidence because you have been able to overcome. But what would you say to somebody who said, "Andrea, I admire you, and I feel a little bit like I've had doors closed, mm-hmm. you know, and it's difficult for me." You know, how do you kind of break past that mentality?
I've heard that quite a bit, actually. And interestingly enough, I won't get into the full details, but in May, I was involved in a very large project where I was actually talking with people who've had major disadvantages in their lifetimes, in their careers. And, you know, they had some serious roadblocks. And it was hard to overlook that and say, well, just get up and pick yourself up by the bootstraps and keep moving. But what I found was the people who were successful and where I've found success is, it's okay to say you don't know. It's okay to acknowledge that, you know, that particular part of me was used against me. The bigger part of your success is to say, what do I need to do now in order to work around it or get the knowledge that I need or get to know the people that I need to know or ask, most importantly, ask the questions I need to be asking in order to move ahead. I think that's the most important part of anyone's success is to say, yeah, there's stuff I don't know. Yeah, there's things that are going to be held against me, but I always have the power to choose to move beyond it in whatever small way is required for me to take one step forward.
See, this is like a little bit of a contrast to the fake it until you make it. You're saying if you don't know it, embrace that you don't
say
know it. Admit it.
Yeah.
And work on learning it.
Yeah. I used to, in my 20s, I was like, I'm just faking it till I make it. You know? Now I'm like, the heck with that. You need to tell everybody, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm going to figure it out. And you get on it in whatever way you possibly can.
It's empowering to say, I don't know, isn't it?
It is.
We say
it's
that on
freeing.
This program all the time.
Right. I don't know the answer.
We embrace it.
I don't say that.
I do. You don't. Yeah. It's because Michelle Faust does know everything.
Well, yes, that's true.
But no, I think it's empowering because what is worse than being on the spot, whether it's in business or anywhere,
yeah,
when you don't know it, but everyone in the audience or everyone around you thinks that you do because you've convinced them that you do? That's
yeah.
tough.
Part of the
work
that I do
eventually.
Is
eventually.
I coach people on how to be more effective public speakers, do media interviews and all that. And the first thing I will tell everybody is you're not going to know every answer. And that's true in life. It's true in a news interview. It's true in a speech. Someone's going to stump you with something. Admit that you don't know the answer. You don't have to say it in that way, but admit that you're committed to finding out what the next step is for you to learn what that answer is. And sometimes it doesn't come in huge waves. You know, my career hasn't been like one day I woke up and it was like, you know, a choir of angels told me what to do. I woke up and said, okay, I'm going to make one phone call, send one email, ask one person, read one, you know, article or whatever it takes to figure out what my next step needs to be. It's resourcefulness. And that's what I've found with people who've been successful, no matter what their background is or whatever they're up against, if you're willing to get crafty and creative in finding a solution, you will always find one.
All right, now let me turn to Julio Sáinz. Now, your own background is probably just as diverse in business as Andrew is. Mm-hmm. Do you do the same thing? You wake up every 4 years and you think it's time for something
for new business? Yeah, I think I think coming here in the immigrant spirit, I think, teaches you to always look for things that need to be created or don't exist. And then if you have the spark, you just want to create them. Especially, I think, in Rochester, where we have a large Hispanic community, and you go to other cities that have similar or smaller Hispanic communities, and you see that they have, you know, these different types of businesses, these different institutions, and you come back and you're like, wow, well, we need that. Somebody should start that. And that's kind of how I've ended up starting a lot of different things.
Including among them, can we talk about what you've created?
Sure.
Because you've been on this program, in fact, in the past, in different capacities.
Right.
Maybe the next time you're on this program, it will be for your next venture.
Yeah, something different.
But kind of give us a little bit of your timeline.
Sure. So, interestingly enough, I studied journalism and mass communications in college and found it very difficult to break into the business. You know, it was sort of, I was born and raised here, so my Spanish wasn't good enough to go work on Telemundo.
Yeah, are you kidding?
Well, it's actually pretty good, but especially back then, you know, compared to some folks, it wasn't good enough to go and work on Telemundo. And then in those days, frankly, let's be honest, a lot of times back then, a lot of media companies had the one Hispanic or the one person of color. And then they had sort of that quota. There was, we got somebody covering the Latin beat, we don't really have a spot for you. And I found that, you know, talking about challenges in careers, it was sort of proving to people that I could do something besides the Hispanic market. And so anyway, I ended up working in the nonprofit sector for a number of years, which was great. I really enjoyed that in community relations and other things. And I saw a need for a Hispanic newspaper. There wasn't one here in Rochester. And so I started Conexión, which was very successful. I think it's a great example of people sort of overlooking the Hispanic market. Someone comes along, starts a paper out of their basement, and it was profitable from the first edition for a number of years. And then the DNC came along and offered to buy it from me, and I went to work for them, and that was a great environment. And so once you've owned a business, you sort of have this itch that never goes away. And so I've worked in the corporate world. I ran a newspaper in Los Angeles for a number of years, just moved back from running a newspaper in Atlanta for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and now I'm doing my consulting. But also part of what I'm doing for consulting is I'm helping Ibero launch a new FM radio station.
See, let me just back up a second here, because you're clearly an entrepreneur, and what you've been able to do is recognize what communities don't have and could use. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people who want to be entrepreneurs, but aren't successful for a number of reasons. Why have you been able? It's almost like you have this great sense for what doesn't exist yet and how to create it. Is that fair to say?
Well, I would welcome that compliment. That would be.
But not everybody can do that, you know. So sure. So I don't know if you have any wisdom to impart on people who want mm-hmm. to be successful in whatever they're creating, but you've been able to do it so well. I mean, again, sure. Go back to the beginning of Conexión. Mm-hmm. You joked that it was out of your basement.
Mm-hmm.
It pretty much was,
yes.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. And I think, honestly, it's going to sound sort of like a Hallmark moment, but a lot of what I've done as far as being an entrepreneur is just wanting to help people. And usually if you can provide people a service that somehow makes their lives better.
I love this.
You can make some money off of it. Originally, when I was going to start Conexión, I was actually contemplating doing it as a nonprofit. And then I thought, well, you know, you can only rely on people's goodwill for so long. If we're going to do this, it needs to be a business that can sustain itself. And it was also a point of pride. It's like, this can be a business. This should be a business.
I love this idea, this advice, because you know, I've probably been there myself. Anybody who's wanted to kind of, I'm going to do my own thing. But if you think, what do I want to do or what's in it for me, mm-hmm. as opposed to what Julio's saying, which is, what does our community need? How can I help people? What do they not have in their lives that I could give them? That's a totally different mentality.
And it's true. I honestly can say that. And I've been successful. I mean, I sold my business to what was then a Fortune 500 company. And it was just out of seeing a need and wanting to fill it. And honestly, I love all the nonprofit things that we do, but sometimes something should be a business.
I do feel like I've got wisdom pouring out of the two microphones. Our guests were like, I don't know. Like, oh my gosh, that is really, really great stuff. So now you're working with Ibero, you said, right? Mm-hmm. On an FM radio station.
Right.
And they have been so involved, and we've got this Upstate Latino Summit coming up on Wednesday. What do you think about the idea of bringing up the upstate community, Albany, Syracuse, Buffalo, Rochester, leaders in these communities, whether it's in government or business, et cetera, for a summit that we have coming up on Wednesday? What do you think, Julio?
I think it's great. I've actually attended the summit when it's been in some other cities. I went to it in Syracuse a number of years ago, and it's powerful. You know, you get all these different leaders in these areas which are facing a lot of the same problems. Mm-hmm. And you can really start to see, well, this kind of worked here, this kind of worked there. And you can really start to cobble together some solutions for a lot of the things that are facing the Hispanic communities in this region.
Andrea Holland has not felt discriminated against, judged based on her gender or ethnicity. You haven't overtly felt it.
I've seen it. I've experienced it. It's been there. I just haven't used it as a crutch for me to say, well, I better throw in the towel and give up now.
Okay, and that hasn't been able to stop you at any point. You might have.
No, I've eaten my feelings over it and cried into my soda for a second, but then I get over it.
You say you've eaten your feelings?
I have a lot of Ben and Jerry moments. Yeah, I've eaten my feelings about it.
I've never heard that expression.
No, there you just heard it now.
but you've overcome it with this kind of determination. Julio, have you felt
Ultimately,
it or experienced
yes.
it?
A lot, to be honest. And I don't talk about it normally because I don't think it does any good. And I don't like to. One thing I think I learned a long time ago was that the minute you start to think of it as racism, it becomes this monolithic thing that you have to, you know, confront. You become Don Quixote facing down a giant instead of someone who's just being a jerk. And that's really what it comes down to. Unfortunately, we run into ignorant people all the time. And some of them, they're choosing to take action based on the way you look. I could tell you horror stories of, you know, police and supervisors, people asking me. I remember once I interviewed for running a high-end magazine, and they were like, well, how would you relate to high-end advertisers? Like, I've been successful at everything I've done. How... The same I would to anybody else. I could tell you dozens of stories like that, but I really try not to focus on them because it doesn't do any good. It really doesn't. And it can cloud your engagement with other people that aren't prejudging you.
But one point on that, because you talk about assessing what's going on, and sometimes someone's just a jerk. Mm-hmm. But there is a difference between racism and prejudice. Racism is sort of what does threaten to hold people down or to take opportunity away or to hurt people. Prejudice is people being a jerk, people being, mm-hmm. you know, having these deep-seated, you know, obviously prejudicial feelings. And I'm curious to know if you have felt the difference between prejudice and racism in your career. You know, has it stopped you? Have you felt like systems have prevented you from doing what you've wanted to do?
Well, if you look at it systematically, I would say so, because one of the things I've tried several times is to break into, because I've run several newspapers and several media companies, to doing something like that in the non-Hispanic market. And it's been impossible, you know, and I always use the example of, hey, I'm not Mexican, but I went to Los Angeles and turned a paper profitable that had lost money 15 years in a row. And I wasn't Mexican. I had to learn to communicate with this community, find out what was important to them in terms of advertising and sales and readership and all these other things. And people don't make that connection. They don't see that those skills are transferable. And I've seen a lot of that. In fact, a few weeks ago, I was presenting to the Latino Leadership Development Program at United Way. We ended up having sort of a sensitivity session there with all the participants talking about how to deal with discrimination and things like that in the workplace, because it is so prevalent. And I actually, after that, I thought about starting like a group therapy club, because everybody had so many difficult stories to tell.
And to make sure I'm clear on the point, mm-hmm. you went to Los Angeles mm-hmm. and took a Mexican paper that was 15 years unprofitable,
yeah.
made it profitable, mm-hmm. even though you're not Mexican.
Right.
And so what you can do is translate your skills to, quote-unquote, other communities. The question that the largely white community has mm-hmm. is, well, but he's a Latino in a Latino community. It's like they're penalizing you.
Right, they don't see the transferable skills. And I use that the Mexican example just because, you know, it's the same skills that it took you to learn how to relate to this community and make it successful, the same that would work with making anything successful.
I sort of have a question for mm-hmm. Julio, and I wonder if you've experienced this. I'm sure you have. I've experienced it professionally on sort of the diminishing side, where it's like I've worked in, you know, PR and marketing communications for years, and people will say, God, there's this, you know, Spanish person on the phone. They're talking all sorts of stuff. I can't mm-hmm. understand them. Andrew, can you go down and talk to them? And I'm going, why am I playing crisis control here?
Right.
Well, but you're the only Spanish speaker we have in the building. I'm like, so suddenly I become important in this case. But before this, I wasn't qualified to speak to the other candidates or the other folks who don't speak Spanish. You just want me now because I'm important in this one setting.
Right.
I've found in my career that that's been a little pigeonholing sometimes. Yeah. Well, give it to Andrea. She'll do it. She speaks Spanish.
She's
and
Spanish
I'm going,
speaker, yeah.
no, that's not all I'm capable of.
Right.
But.
And that's sort of a completion to the point I was making earlier, where not only is it not seen as transferable skills, but it's seen as some sort of like magic that you do.
Yeah.
Like it's, you know, well, you know, he did that Hispanic thing. He did a couple.
You're so good at that.
Did a couple salsa moves and everything worked out. You know, and it wasn't business principles. It wasn't, you know, what I learned in graduate school. It was something else.
Yeah. And that makes me sad, but I'm amazed with what you both have been able to do.
Thank you.
So, let me just wrap by saying we wanted to bring them in to get their perspective as two individuals who've been successful in business. There's not one single answer for Latinos in business, obviously. But what we all can do, whether we are Latino or not, is not just categorize people so often.
Yes.
Because Julio Sáenz is somebody who should be on, you probably should be hired for whatever job you want to walk in for. Andrea, you the same.
Thank
so
you.
thanks for your expertise and some of your background there. The Upstate Latino Summit is this coming Wednesday at the Rochester Riverside Convention Center. We're previewing that both hours on the program today. We're going to get a short break and come back and talk healthcare, and we're also going to talk education as well with our next guest. So short break, come right back. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections. What does it mean to be a voter who's considering issues related to the environment and climate change? What are the candidates saying for office? The candidates who are running in this year's elections, even on the local level? How is climate change an issue? That's the first hour. Then second hour, it's our monthly science roundtable. Talk with you on Monday.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
Philadelphia wants to revive public interest in its blighted waterfront by building attractions on the cheap.
Take a look around this park. We're using old cargo containers, which honestly aren't that expensive.
Low-cost solutions that are drawing crowds to the river. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That'll be this afternoon at 4 on your NPR News station.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Michelle Faust is co-hosting these 2 hours with me from our WXXI newsroom. And we just had a big change out. A lot of people in the studio now as we're getting ready for the Upstate Latino Summit, which is coming up this Wednesday. And what would you like to talk about next, Michelle? There's all
these
issues.
We're talking health.
Talking health next. We have all these issues that are coming up and are so important to this community. So let's go ahead and introduce our next guest. Okay, let's go around. We're going to go around the table. If you've got a microphone, say hello, introduce yourself, and we'll talk healthcare. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Sadie Fisher, and I am the Consumer Engagement Program Manager for Finger Lakes Health Systems Agency and one of the presenters at the summit.
Hi, Sadie. Nice to have you back here.
Thanks. Great to see you again.
I'm Gladys Pedraza-Burgos. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at Ibero-American Action League and also the Chair of the Latino Health Coalition.
Okay.
Guys, hi, I'm Jim Sutton. I'm a practicing physician assistant at Clinton Family Health Center and also the director of community medicine at Rochester Regional Health.
Okay, very good. Well, let's kind of go around the table here. And Michelle, you have reported so extensively in our community on health care and different matters, whether it's the ACA or others. What are sort of the big issues that kind of come to mind for you as a reporter as we head for the Upstate Latino Summit?
Well, I mean, I think the biggest thing that we can talk about are disparities in healthcare. And I really want our group to talk about from their perspective. One thing that was one of the first stories, the bigger stories that I did when I came to WXXI as we were rolling out the Affordable Care Act was Latinos were the least insured of any demographic, and the Affordable Care Act did a lot of things to try to address that. There's some argument of how well that worked, and I just wanted to get from your perspective, what are the big disparities among Latinos and healthcare at this point, post-ACA? I'll start with you, Jim.
Well, when you think about healthcare disparities, you have to try to remember what's driving those disparities. It's the social determinants of health. And access and delivery of health care, of course, is very important, but I think the ACA has done a reasonably good job at getting people insured and getting them access into care. But these social determinants, where you live, the environment you're living in, the decisions you're making, the support network you have around you is what's really driving these disparities. And what's interesting in the most recent Nuestra Salud report in 2014, mm-hmm. you could see the disparities countywide kind of evening out with the Latinos and the whites. But if you go down into the Northeast sector, into, 621, 605, the gap is actually widening.
So my question there is, are the disparities among healthcare when it comes to Latinos, is that something that it deals with Latinos, or is that really an economic issue?
I would say it's a combination of both. I mean, really what we see out of the reports that Jim was just referring to is that we do see for Latinos specifically poor health outcomes, specifically in the zip codes 14605, 13, and 21. So definitely place matters when it comes to healthcare. But also even within those zip code areas, Latinos are faring worse off than even their other, than their white and African-American counterparts mm-hmm. within those same regions. So, for example, going back to, insurance coverage, for Latino adults under the age of 65, we're twice as likely to be uninsured than our white counterparts. So we're still seeing that issue around insurance. When it comes to poverty in those target zip codes, we're definitely 46% of Latinos fall underneath the federal poverty level. So within those regions, we definitely see still higher levels of these disparities within Latinos.
Gladys, and I want you to chime in there.
Absolutely. And so the Nuestro Salud report actually focused on those zip codes that Sadie was mentioning. And these are the outcomes that we found was that just in terms of poverty plays a big role in your health outcomes. I mean, the quality of life and the same thing around the social determinants about where you live, your level of education as well. And language also presents a problem as well. For some, that is still a big barrier, having healthcare professionals that are not necessarily able to communicate with them in Spanish. So that cultural competency piece still continues to play a role for the quality of life in terms of healthcare.
I have lots of questions about having a conversation about cultural competency, but let's stick with language. For somebody who doesn't know, a person who is monolingual English, who doesn't deal with that kind of a barrier, what is that like when you go in to see a medical professional and you don't speak the language?
Well, I can recall very vividly, you know, my mother who was illiterate both in English and also in Spanish as well, going to her appointments to see the doctor. And it is very awkward, uncomfortable, and sometimes I know she has always expressed to me that she was very embarrassed because, you know, here it is, her daughter having to interpret. And I'm not, you know, astute around medical terminologies. And so trying to interpret that as a young child for my mother so that she can make the most of her hospital visit definitely decreases the quality and the value of that visit, of that care that's going to be provided for her.
And the conversation that I've heard before, and I'd love for you guys to chime in as well, is that also puts strain on that relationship. I wonder if you had that experience.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think there's an issue of trust as well, not taking into account one's culture. I remember the doctor saying, "Okay, make sure your mother takes these medicines, and she'll start to feel better." And when I would explain it to my mother, she would say, "Well, si Dios permite." And not taking into account that religion sometimes plays a big role in the healing process, as does other factors, you know, nutrition, diet, exercise, those things as well.
Jim, do we have enough doctors in our area that are culturally competent to deal with the Latino community?
We do not. We never have, and hopefully someday we will. At Rochester Regional, we placed a clinic down on Clinton Avenue, Clinton Family Health Center. All the providers there are bilingual. Language is important. If you can't speak the language, you have to do the visit through the interpreter, which is less than a one-to-one conversation. But it's really the cultural competency, you know, the ability to understand who that person is, to have a respect for how they became who they are, and to be able to connect with them, because changing a person's behavior comes from a trusting relationship, and you can't develop that trusting relationship without a sense of cultural competency. I'm hoping that we are doing that down at Clinton Family Health. All the providers there, in my opinion, are very culturally competent, but, you know, with how many Latinos we have in Rochester and a half a dozen providers providing that care, there's a disparity right there in terms of having enough physicians and PAs and nurse practitioners in Rochester that have that cultural competency to take care of this particular group of people.
What are you seeing, Sadie?
Well, I was going to add to that, kind of going back to your question about just relationships and the strain even for between the patient and their interpreter. I mean, I think about myself as a mother, and if my son's translating for me, kind of going back to what you're saying, Gladys, I mean, how honest am I going to be with the provider, too, about some of the things that I really am feeling or some of my behaviors? Because do I want necessarily my child to know some of these things? And also, too, how much can a child know about interpreting the information that they're hearing from a provider? So even from a confidentiality standpoint, from just even very basics on being able to have that quality of care between me and a provider, people don't realize it's not just the language, but it's also about we deserve to have that privacy, and it's harder to do so when our translators are our family members or a friend, and how much we really want them to know about what's going on in our lives.
But so, I think just the vocabulary of a medical translator is different than
absolutely
a regular person. I've done translation before in certain contexts, but there's other contexts that I would not be proficient with the vocabulary.
Exactly. Absolutely. I mean, even in English, right? It's hard for many of us to, even if we speak the language and providers are speaking English, to understand half the times what it is that our provider is telling us, let alone to have our family members trying to translate and understand that information too.
So just keep in mind that anytime you're talking about healthcare, it is a huge field. I mean, it's what I just wanted to pick up on what Jim was saying. You know, you have nurses, you also have dental care, you have eye care, you have the specialties as well as, you know, those that are in the pharmaceutical at the drugstore. So it goes beyond just that one-on-one with the physician in the examining room.
So when we're talking about these healthcare disparities, first we were talking about healthcare, having the providers available, but there are some diseases that touch the Latino community at greater prevalency, heart disease, cancer, diabetes. Mm-hmm. What are some of the prevention efforts that we can maybe start to make some strides in? What do you think, Jim?
Well, I think in the Latino culture, diabetes, of course, hands down, is the biggest problem. You know, nationwide, we have this epidemic of obesity, which has been driving a lot of the diabetes in our country. But genetically, Latinos are predisposed to become diabetics more often than whites. You know, I think every Latino patient I've ever met has a mother or a grandmother or somebody that has diabetes. And I often tell them that this genetic predisposition doesn't mean you're going to become diabetic, but it's the obesity or the weight that flicks the switch and makes it happen. And so, you know, from a preventative standpoint, it comes down to the basics: diet, weight loss, and living a healthier lifestyle.
So what do you think we can do as far as outreach to the community to kind of do some prevention when it comes to diabetes, but even cancer and heart disease?
I think that, you know, when it comes to diabetes specifically, you have to continue to recall the social determinants and how economics plays a big role, because even being able to get access to healthy food sometimes could be difficult. It's not impossible. I think Food Link locally has done a lot to make sure that they're getting food trucks and fresh fruits and vegetables available to most. But I think, like anything else with health, it's about education and it's about making sure that people have access to health care and that they have a really good relationship with their health care providers, as opposed to going to the emergency room.
When it comes to that, like, what about the education factor? I mean, Jim mentioned that we have to educate the community and kind of get people to understand some of these factors that will cause issues with their health if they don't know about it. What's the outreach? What can we do to get people educated?
Well, there's a variety of different initiatives that are taking place, and I think it's going to take a multifaceted approach. We can't just kind of take it on in one way, but I mean, starting off in the schools, doing some of the education so we're reaching students, having parent education, going back to providers, making sure that there is education with patients that they can actually understand and information that they can take home that's actually applicable. Because oftentimes we get brochures, we get information, and no one's asking us, can you afford to make some of these changes? Can you know, do you have access? Is Food Link in your area? Can you access the curbside market, et cetera? And so I think those are some of the things. And then also looking at some of the initiatives, such as like the Healthy Kids Initiative over at Finger Lakes Health Systems Agency, where we're doing things around, you know, healthier school lunches in the schools, doing education with parents and talking about healthier recipes to try at home, as well as safe play. So making sure that kids and adults are getting involved in active play and at least getting in, you know, 60 minutes of active of activity in as well. So there are various things that are kind of happening. And the nice thing about it, even the people here around this table are all parts of these various initiatives, whether it's from the provider standpoint, from the organizational standpoint, or even from best practices, looking at the data and saying, where do we need to target in order to make sure that our efforts are reaching those that we need to reach?
We've been previewing the Upstate Latino Summit, which is this coming Wednesday, and we're covering five different issues over these 2 hours. We talked politics and immigration in our first hour, and we're talking business, healthcare, and in just a moment, we're going to switch over and talk education. Before we do that, I'd like our guests just to leave us with some final thoughts. And by the way, if you're hearing the tintinnabulation of a wardrobe, Sadie's got some it looks really good. I'm hearing it, though. And our listeners can't see it, but you look great.
Well, thank you.
It's a series of beads there.
Is that what is making that noise?
I guess
bracelets.
Oh, it's the bracelets.
It's the bracelets.
Oh, see, that's what happens when you wear jewelry.
Sadie's like one of the most stylish guests we always have on this program. Before we let you go, this has been, this is an important issue, one of many important issues in the Latino communities in upstate New York, the Upstate Summit coming up on Wednesday. Sadie, what do you want to leave the listeners with when it comes to sort of healthcare and macro? We've been talking about these, the issues that are facing them. What do you want to leave the listeners with?
I would say first, come to the summit if you can. So go onto the website, go onto Ibero's website and register. But in addition to that, remember that you can be your biggest advocate. So don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't be afraid to say, I don't understand. And don't be afraid to demand the things that you need in order to keep yourself and your families healthy.
Okay.
Absolutely. I'm going to just kind of reiterate to come to the summit because we have some other panelists that were not able to be with us today that are coming from Buffalo. And also we have Beverly Severus that's coming to talk about migrant health as well. So it is going to cover all of upstate New York. And what we're going to find is there are some things that we can be doing to prevent some of the chronic disease that we see in the community.
Okay.
Yeah, so Summit's a unique opportunity. There's some people in Rochester, Buffalo, and Syracuse that are making some headway in these areas. There's some best practices out there, and this is a great opportunity to get everybody together and share these with each other and make some progress.
Your colleagues at Ibero, by the way, I've been told to make sure we mention, if you can register, great, get on the website. But if you don't, you want to just be there on Wednesday. They said that's great. It's at the Rochester Riverside Convention Center this coming Wednesday. So open to all. That's one of the big messages. Thanks to Jim Sutton, Gladys Pedraza-Burgos, and Sadie Fisher. Thanks to all of you for being
here.
Thanks for having us.
And thanks for discussing these very important issues. And now we shift the conversation to education. And in many ways, as Anna Casserly, our next guest, was telling us, Anna was telling me that you really can't separate healthcare from education. So as she gets settled in and grabs the headphones and bring that mic nice and close to you, Anna Casserly is an advocate for the rights of children with disabilities. And it's nice to have you. Thank you for being here, first of all.
Thank you for inviting me.
And we were talking in the hallway before we came in here, and you said you just cannot separate education and healthcare. Why?
Because in this moment, we lack of social workers. We lack of support for the families and the children, especially in special education. At this moment, we are the higher children. They have the risk. They don't get the appropriate plans, appropriate education for us. I'm a parent, and I have a group of parents that we're passing through the same thing. Every year, we don't know where a child go. Sometimes our children get moved four times out of schools because they cannot find the right placement.
Mm. So as an advocate for the rights of children with disabilities, when we look at education as an issue facing the Latino community in upstate New York, is funding, is resources, is that the biggest issue? What's the biggest issue?
The funding is the big issue. They don't have the right programs. Think about it. This child don't speak English or don't speak Spanish. This child comes here and they squeeze you in a program that your child is not the right placement. Especially if you have a disability, you know you have an individual plan that you bring for another place telling you that your child have a disability. They don't care. You have to wait through all this process and you miss 6 months of that child's life that is like a year for us. And the funding, the programs they create, all this is not the right programs for our children. And we had to wait sometimes our kids at home until they can find a school or a chair for them.
Hmm. What's going to change that then, Anna?
I think with this summer we'll change it. They hear the parents, hear us to say, this is not working. This is not working for our children. We need change. We need more support. Because when you change my child four times at different schools, you affect my child the rest of their life. They don't have friends. They don't create in the community. You don't go to your school in your community. Because why? It happened to me. Like a mother, when somebody tell you, you don't have the right to come to this school because we don't have a program. That's the hurt thing that can happen to you like a parent because they don't have nothing for your child.
Anna is an advocate for the rights of children with disabilities, and the organization you work with is?
Oh, we are a group of parents that we create this to help each other because we still cannot find the right place for us, the people to hear us. Because it's not only that we work with Iberos, help us to find a lawyer to help us to do mediations because a lot of the kids was not going to school. We had children a year without no programs. And now, finally, we have a little programs, but we still don't have enough money, enough quality teachers, and quality things for our children.
And Anna's going to be here for the rest of the hour. Let me welcome our other guest as well. Anthony Planzinski-Figueroa is on the line with us. He's with the Latino Educational Task Force and has a long list of credentials beyond that. Anthony, it's nice to have you back on the program. How are you?
Doing well, Evan. Thank you for having me on.
And let me ask you, tell us sort of broadly what the Latino Educational Task Force is, Anthony.
Well, you know, listening in just now, you know, a lot of the reasons that were just brought up in terms of the bureaucratic barriers and the lack of resources for our students was a big impetus of why the Latino Education Task Force came to be. You know, for a long time, a lot of individuals have said that, you know, you don't have data, you don't have resources to prove the problem within the educational community for Latinos. And so the task force came together in 2008 with researchers from the University of Rochester Warner School to really highlight and underline the problem that we have had and been discussing for decades within the educational community around the nation. And so we came together to focus on the Rochester City School District issues with Latino students in that community. And it has been a group of parents, has been a group of advocates, and has been a group of community members coming together to find ways to improve educational outcomes for Latinos and what the district and others can do to help.
Justin Murphy in the Democrat and Chronicle wrote a piece about Anna and your family. And
yes.
An excellent piece, I thought. And if you missed that, can you tell us a little bit more about your story, Anna?
The story was about three parents. One parent, they have a child with special needs, and the second child, they came to Rochester in only less than 6 months, and he was be suspension all the time because they don't understand they have a disability. They put him in a regular class. He used to go 5 days to school, and he gets suspended Monday. When he go back Monday to school, and then he gets suspension another 5 days because that's where the regulation said you cannot suspend that child more than the 10 days. Where they're doing that until they can finish the evaluation. Final, it took close to a year to finish evaluate the child and find out what is his needs. And that's one of my stories that we had there. We have another story, a child that she tried to went back to school, but because she have a problem with her speech, they tell her, you're not allowed to come back. You're already 16 and you're a mother. Things like that is still happening. When I wrote that one, it was like it's going to be a year ago when we start to find all this. It's still getting worse and worse. This not getting better. It's not getting better.
Well, Anthony, as a member then of the task force, when you hear it's not getting better yet, you know, what is going to change that? Your world is more connected to sort of the political machinery out there. You know, you're a very smart person. You understand a lot of how the game is played. How is it going to change?
I think that this is definitely the clarion call of our community within the Latino community, and that in order to make things change, the only way we're going to have to do is to learn how to advocate and fight better for those resources. I mean, the fact that we have students, as Anna's talking about, that have to go through all these hoops and obstacles, and it seems that, you know, oftentimes these bureaucratic systems work harder to find ways to navigate our students out of the system than working hard enough to get them to be in the system, it's troubling. And so the lack of knowledge and understanding that our community needs within the educational system, you know, I think that we are at a point where advocacy is the only way. We're going to have to rattle doors. We're going to have to rattle phones. We're going to have to pound the pavement just to get the information out there that our students deserve more, they need more, and that they actually belong in this system and that they're not just some kind of extra part to it. And regardless of, you know, the fact that we do have a lot of challenges out there, but they need to be addressed and has gone on long enough.
Go ahead, Anna.
But let me explain another thing. Remember when they did the Metro Justice, they did the Pine Line, the suspensions, all the kids that you have, it was 1.3 children get in suspension, and that children were children with disabilities. Why they get in that kid suspension? Because they don't have a program. They don't, because they don't, can I speak English or they can I speak Spanish? And that was the reason Monroe High School, all these high schools and all the regular school were suspending these kids. Not because the kids were behavior, it's because they don't have no placement for them. And don't tell me that it's going to change, because this is happening for the past 9 years. And before me was somebody else fighting for the same right. This is not new. This is not something that I came out because I have a child now with disability. He's 16 years old. No, this is going on for years. We can advocate. We can scream. I go with signs. I go to Albany with all these families. We still see no change. They don't have respect for us. Especially where you have an accent, you are a woman, and you have a child with disability. They think you ignorant. They sit in a table. They treat you bad. They make you feel like you less. Your child is not a child no more in the moment they have an IEP. It's a paper. It's a piece of paper. They forget it's a child. They forget they have a right to get an appropriate education. That's his right.
Go ahead, Anthony.
And Evan, I mean, being on your show before, and I believe Anna can't see me because I'm on the phone, obviously, but I believe Anna was in one of our workshops recently for the civic engagement in the Latino community, and we talked about how, you know, my counselor from high school got me involved and dragged me out of bed and dragged me down to learn more about the issues of bilingual education and learn more about how to advocate for our community. I mean, we need 100 more Annas. With the sleeping giant that the Latino community is being labeled all across this nation needs to wake up. And if we do not wake up, the cost is going to be the future of our kids.
Mm-hmm. And I hate to ask you this, but you don't seem optimistic for change.
No, because I'm waiting. Every time we try, they try to put like a little bandage to quiet us. Okay? Now the new thing is, okay, you send it out the district. Send it out the district when the kids don't have the right programs. How you can come and tell to a mom, we don't have a chair for your child. How you say, we're going to send a teacher. We don't have program for your child in this moment, but we're going to send a teacher home. And we're still waiting for the teacher the past 2 weeks. How you can tell me that every year you see these people lining big lines outside the district, the second day of school, because they put the children in the wrong placement. The lines go around. And these parents every year go through the same thing. How you feel that you don't ask them for nothing else? We don't want nothing free. We only want our child to have the proper education. That way they can get a job. We don't care if they work in McDonald's. We don't care if they mop floors. We don't ask them to be a president, a lawyer, a doctor. What are you doing not giving the right support for our kids? You're destroying our future, my child's future and my future, because I spend more time in there fighting for him than what I spend in time with my family. This is not affect only us. Disability don't have a color, race, or you're rich or poor. When they hit you, they treat you the same way. I'm not here because I'm Hispanic. I'm here because all the parents that I speak feel in the same way. What's going on with us?
It's hard to hear the story, but I understand the emotion. And let me get a phone call in here. This is Bonnie in Rochester. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yes, I know we have a short time here, but a couple things. And first of all, Anna, my name is Bonnie Canaan, and I've actually been trying to get a hold of you to talk about this issue with disabilities and the Hispanic population to present some issues before candidates. But just mention that. Maybe you could let Evan know how to get in touch with you. But I want to say something, and there's never enough time for these things. That's a big problem. I worked with New York State with people with disabilities for over 30 years, and the program that we did was an outreach community program that had, I'm going to say this quickly because of time, interdisciplinary team, a whole range of clinical people that work with every family, long-term follow-up, social workers and the family were the key piece. Strong advocacy. That program was valued highly by families for 30-some years until what happened? when the governor went after the unions in his first term, he's, if you remember, people probably don't remember, but if you remember, there was huge, he wanted to get rid of a whole lot of staff. And that was a kind of a threatening thing he did. So as that played out, it didn't actually turn out to have those numbers. But in playing out, what people don't realize, when you start to shake up a system, it starts to crumble at the lower levels because the people, the local management, start to get real nervous and they start threatening people, not, you know, violent, but they start, you know, so people get nervous. So what happened, the short of this is that whole program, with a very little exception, was totally eliminated. Totally eliminated. It had advocacy that reached into the school. I should have said that was one of the things. We had advocacy and strong advocacy with parents and everything and all the systems, and it was follow-up. So that some of these things are getting away with now, which I think you were saying before should never have been because they're long supposed to be over with in terms of some of the things you're mentioning. Those things we would not tolerate, and we went up against the schools along with the families to do that. It outrages me to hear these are still going on. But some of the blame for this goes to the governor for causing the conditions that eliminated these programs. Because people, you know, people don't like systems that go up against other systems with their power and confront them, which is what we used to do to be able to get, you know, services and to follow people. We work strongly with families, relationships, the whole nine yards. So that piece needs to be out there much more. That program should be reinstated.
All right, Bob.
Okay, thank you.
I know she's fired up, and I understand why. We're just up against it. And I suspect, Anna, that same passion is, in many ways, how you've been feeling the same frustration.
Yes, the same frustration. The only thing is we don't have enough advocates for Spanish people. I'm the only one. In this moment, advocate for the parents. I don't know where, and they create these advocate centers, all these programs, and we're not included when it comes to us.
Well, go out next Wednesday, if you care about these issues, to the Upstate Latino Summit. Learn how to get involved. Anna, thank you for your time.
And thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. And Anthony Planzinski, when she says she feels like the only one, you're saying wake up and get involved here. Thanks for the time, yeah. Anthony.
Thank you.
Anthony's with the Latino Educational Task Force. That message driven home. Thank you, Michelle Faust, for two powerful hours. The Upstate Latino Summit is this coming Wednesday at the Rochester Riverside Convention Center. Have a great weekend.